Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Gabe Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson. We open today with President Trump's surprising dismissal of FBI Director James Comey. Now, initial reports from administration officials were that the president went along with the move instigated by Attorney General Jeff Sessions and particularly Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who was confirmed only a few weeks ago. Now, officials also stated that the dismissal had nothing to do with the ongoing FBI investigation of ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, an investigation that some say had been gaining steam in recent weeks, with Director Comey reportedly asking for more resources, though this is disputed, and receiving daily instead of weekly briefings on the progress of the investigation. Now, the ostensible reason for firing Comey was his handling of the Hillary Clinton email server investigation, but later in the week, in an interview with NBC, President Trump himself may have contradicted the administration's story by saying that he was going to fire Comey regardless of the Department of Justice's recommendation, and that he said to himself, "You know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story," suggesting that the investigation may have played a role in the decision. After dismissing Comey, Trump then took to Twitter to issue what some call a threat against the former FBI director, tweeting, "James Comey better hope there are no tapes of our conversation before he starts leaking to the press." So, Jay, what do you make of all this craziness this week?
Well, it's just another fun week in Trump's Washington. I'd say a couple of things. First, on the merits, I think there is a good case that Comey should have been let go. And I think it's probably beneficial in the long run that he was. That said, the way Trump handled it, which is the usual kind of ham-handed way that Trump handles a lot of things, was terrible, was botched. And again, it's sort of akin to the travel ban rollout, where again, if you're going to do this, there's a better way to do this. I mean, I would, first of all, on the merits, I'd say people really should look at the Rosenstein memo, because it goes into detail to saying, hey, here's what this guy did wrong and what he's been doing and shouldn't be doing. And I think that's appropriate. Those were appropriate reasons. The problem is then Trump sort of completely screwed that all up by saying, well, I was going to fire him anyway. And doing it in the way he did. I mean, the only thing that could have been sort of more goofy over the top would have been doing it, you know, in the style of the Apprentice, which would have been really fun television, though, also with the, you know, you call the cabinet in the boardroom and, you know, yeah, Somebody's got to go this week and, you know, and it's who should leave. It would have been fun, but no, I don't think that it's a cover up type thing, but what it does, it adds fuel to that fire. I don't think it's going to change anything regarding investigations going forward or not going forward. Most of those investigations are outside of the FBI. They're in Congress. To me, it's one of these. It's another unforced error on Trump where, he had a week of he can move forward with health care, with tax policy, take a bit of a victory lap. And really what he should have been doing this week instead of dealing with questions about Comey and the Russians and so forth, should have been selling the health care plan in the Senate and helping a representative sell that at home. And to me, it's one of those missed opportunities because he's sort of chasing down this. He's getting into a fight that he didn't need to get into. At least he didn't need to get into it right now.
Yeah, and we've said it, you know, a number of times before. Trump is he might not be his own worst enemy. He has plenty of pretty bad enemies, but certainly right. He's a big enemy to himself. You know, this lack of coordination, lack of planning, lack of talking points. You know, the whole it's pretty much seemed like a spur of the moment. You know, the what we hear from so many sources is Trump gets all upset about something he sees on TV, makes an impulsive decision, isn't interested in planning or coordinating anything. And you know, to me, there are sort of two possibilities here. Number one, the FBI was in fact getting too close to something, or that President Trump just simply has terrifically poor impulse control. I guess it could be both, you know.
Right.
But there's a saying that wrongly, from what I understand, attributed to Napoleon, never ascribe to malice that which can be adequately explained by ignorance, or in this case, you know, really bad impulse control. And so, right. I certainly think that there could be something with the whole Russia thing, and maybe it was designed to kind of stop that investigation. But to me, that, you know, kind of using that sort of Occam's razor sort of approach to it, that the simplest explanation is just that Trump is a super impulsive guy who just acts boom like that. And that's kind of what's going on there, you know, and pretty.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that makes a lot more sense, because, again, if his goal was to stop end the investigation.
Exactly.
This certainly wouldn't do it.
Yeah. It just makes it worse.
He didn't fire the entire FBI. And his Comey successor right now is very much he's been described as a Comey loyalist. You know, if anything, it might make some people dig a little deeper. So I don't. Again, if that was the plan, it was a terribly poorly executed. But I think this is more what you get, though. And we talked about this way back when Trump was initially running. This idea of, well, we're going to run government like a business and we need a business leader in there to do things and to shake things up. There are things you can do in your own business that just don't work in government, in politics. And well, one of the things you can do in your own company is if somebody upsets you, angers you, you can just go and fire them. It's different in this other world. And Trump seems to not have realized that yet.
Yeah, you know, I almost feel sorry for Trump's communications people, because pretty clearly they're tasked with an almost impossible job here. Sure. And they're basically have to go out there and lie for the president. It puts them in impossible positions. And, you know, like the idea that the FBI people really just were demoralized and hated Director Comey when, you know, there are plenty of people in the FBI said it's totally not the case. And especially if you're somebody who is pushing back hard against leaks, and we know that leaks drive President Trump, they drive any president crazy, right. But especially this guy. This is exactly the wrong thing to do. You can expect the leaks now to come hard and fast. And then when you make this threat, what a stupid thing. You know, back in 1974, Congress passed something called the Presidential Recordings and Materials Preservation Act. And what that did was it made all tapes that any president makes, including if you tape stuff on your cell phone, that would count as a presidential record that has to be preserved, and it also can be subpoenaed. It's illegal to destroy it or alter it in any way. And so right there, President Trump opened himself up to this. I mean, the only reasoning I can think about is that he's just acting without thinking. You know, it's just really, really dumb, basically.
Yeah, that's my sense. There was a piece, and I'm trying to think where it was. It might have been the Atlantic, but the message was, look, we need to stop trying to overanalyze Trump or analyze him at all, and just accept it. He really is just what he appears to be.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, more of that's coming to a head. And this is another situation where he got out in front of the story without having things set up. And then again, I'm not saying that Comey shouldn't have been fired, because I think that was appropriate. But this was not the way to do it. And this was a poor rollout. And, it could have been done in a much more harmonious way for Trump, for Comey, for everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, and the President Trump has said that he hopes to name to nominate a successor very soon. And of course, those hearings are going to be very, very interesting. And, you know, one concern that some people, especially,
although one name that has been floated for that position was Merrick Garland.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. That was floated as kind of a ridiculous sort of, well, if we can get this Democrat off of the DC circuit and have President Trump appoint a Republican, that was just one of those ridiculous things. That
DC will not circuit's happen. A much better job.
Yeah, without a doubt. But, you know, one thing I'd point out, though, is that there's a concern among some on the left, especially, that even though there are these House and Senate investigation going on, at least the Senate investigation's a real one, the House one I don't know so much about, but, you know, they are relying to a certain extent on the FBI for some of their information and so forth. And so the FBI really is critical to all these investigations. Another thing I wanted to point out is that while the media and the left certainly has gone nuts about this, Trump's job approval among Republicans is still really, really great. I mean, the high 70s, low 80s, and that's not going to change because they're not, you know, everyone's in their little silos and they're exposed to the kind of media cheerleading of, you know, on Fox and so forth. And they don't see it as a problem. You know, looking at it from a Trump supporter point of view, which I tried to do, is, well, okay, you know, sure, President Trump supported Comey during the election, his comment about how it took guts to do what he did with the Hillary Clinton email thing. But, you know, then you could say, well, once he became president, he learned more about the situation, found out that Comey was a showboat, and he was pushing this fake Russia story for his own, you know, self-aggrandizement. Right. And then he makes this testimony where he says he's mildly nauseous at the thought that his actions might have turned the election to Trump. And so, you know, Comey's not a team player. You can say that maybe he seems like he's actively out to get the president. And so he had a go. And the fact that President Trump did this now shows that he doesn't care about appearances, political correctness. He's going to do the right thing regardless. And so, you know, and despite Comey's support within the bureau and so forth, that Trump just said, this is the right thing to do. We need to do it now. Now, that's not the narrative I believe, but I certainly could see that as a narrative a lot of Trump supporters would actively embrace.
Well, you know, I think it's, and again, I wouldn't call myself a Trump supporter, but no, I think there's a lot of sense to that. And if anything, it's one of those, you know, which Donald Trump are you talking about? Was he acting more responsibly back on the campaign trail when he was praising Comey for criticizing Hillary Clinton? Or is he acting more appropriate now where he's getting rid of him for the showboating and so forth? So, you know, again, my sense is, you know, maybe I think he did the right thing anyway. And this goes back to Comey's issues with appointing a special prosecutor, Fitzgerald, in the Scooter Libby matter. And you know, again, it's not just this, but no, I don't see it as I understand how Trump supporters could do that. But keep in mind, Trump supporters are exposed to the rest of the media.
I think more so than
liberals are exposed to conservative media. I think conservatives are exposed to more of the liberal culture. But you know, regardless, I think there's a good argument to be seen, and I really think this is going to play out. And you know, we will talk about this throughout the summer. We would all put a marker down now. That I think there is nothing to the Russia story. There's everything that's been supposedly a bombshell revelation that's going to be come out has just sort of fizzled.
I don't know. The Flynn thing is still pretty, you know, there seems to be an awful lot there. The Flynn part of the story seems to be an awful lot there.
All right. So the Flynn part of the story is he accepted money and he didn't report it. And that's problematic. And he accepted, or he had a phone call and he didn't report that. That is problematic. But again, there, you know, I haven't seen the piece tying Flynn or anything that Flynn did to the president seeking to influence the election.
Well, you know, and the case to make, at least from the left, and the case that I sort of think there's something to is there are a lot of little things that add up. You know, you have the Flynn thing, you have the Carter Page thing,
The Carter Page thing turned out, I mean, a situation where, look, Trump never met with Carter Page, and the Russians really didn't have much to say about Page.
No, I agree.
To the extent he was involved or approached, he cooperated with the FBI and helped catch Russian spies a couple of years ago. Sure, I just don't see.
But I think you're missing my point here, maybe. Maybe I'm not articulating it well enough. I'm not saying that any one of these individual things is huge, but you start adding these things together, and then you add in the fact that the president didn't release his tax returns, and there's a lot of speculation. In fact, a lot of things that Trump people have said in the past about how much money they've gotten in financing from the Russians and so forth. Sure. And you add up that all of those things, and it starts to feel like something. And when you have an administration that is so unwilling to be transparent and so defensive about these things, it understandably makes people wonder. And so maybe there is nothing to this, maybe nothing will come of it, but I'm not as sure about that as you are. But you're right, we will find out. And you know, before we move on from this story, I mentioned this on Facebook a few days ago on our page. I'm actually starting to think that the election of Donald Trump might have been a good thing for the United States. And when I said that, there were a couple of people who sort of freaked out on the Facebook page. And I said I'd try to make my case.
I expressed mild surprise, but yes.
Yeah, well here's the thing. I started to think about an alternate universe where Hillary Clinton was president, okay? Now, to me, that would, and I think to a lot of liberals, that would be a definite downgrade from the Obama presidency. I have a lot more faith in the integrity and the competence and the trustworthiness of President Obama than I do in Hillary Clinton for a lot of reasons that stretch back decades, right? And I could see what the result of a Clinton presidency would be. It would be, number one, more Democratic losses in the 2018 midterms, then facing a 2020 general election with big Republican majorities in the House and the Senate that would get even bigger, possibly filibuster-proof, and then you get a truly conservative person like, I don't know, Ted Cruz, who's not only much more conservative than I'd like, but almost certainly going to be a lot more competent than someone like a Donald Trump. And that's a truly scary scenario for me, and I see this kind of going the other way, is that the Trump, you know, election kind of shook Democrats out of their malaise, and I start to see a 2018 and a 2020 that look an awful lot better. And so when I kind of play these things out, and granted, you know, that's years into the future, I almost wonder, well, maybe this longer term, again, was a good thing for the Democratic Party and for the country. And that's not to say that I think that Donald Trump isn't, well, essentially a reprehensible human being, but you know, kind of looking longer term, maybe trying to find that silver lining, sort of that's how I'm thinking about it now.
I see. Well, you're kind of like the coach going in at halftime and you're down 27-0 and you're saying, we got them right where we want them now.
Well, you know, I understand, but the fact of the matter is it's heartening to me that Donald Trump and his administration are so incredibly incompetent, because, you know, I think if we could just hang on, Democrats, until after the 2018 elections, then I think there's a really good chance we'll have a House majority and nothing legislatively will be done. And so I see where you're going with the analogy, but I don't think it's fitting.
No, here's why I would say where it benefits Democrats is at this point. When you have Republican control of both houses of Congress and the presidency, Republicans are on the hook for everything,
exactly.
No matter what.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the best argument that you have. And I think that's sort of what you're saying in part, is that, there's no more dodging. It's easy and fun, to be in the minority and just kind of be in the back benchers and, you know, bomb throwers and so forth, because you don't really have the responsibility of governing. Because governing is a lot tougher than just being in the minority.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I guess I would also say before we move on that the only thing, of course, that is going to be really hard to recover from are the judicial appointments, you know, and there's a good chance that President Trump might have one more, two more, who knows, appointments to the Supreme Court. And of course, the lower, you know, federal courts, they're also, he's going to have a lot of appointments there. And that's the kind of thing where that resonates over, you know, over decades. And so that's a lot harder to recover from. And I don't want to minimize what I think the damage that some of those appointments will do.
But if you retake Congress, then you won't so much need the judiciary.
Well, at least
that's a little snarky kind of.
Okay. you know, there was actually some non-Comey related news this week, though it's understandable, I think, if people missed it. You know, one story that caught my attention was Attorney General Jeff Sessions withdrawing the 2013 directive from Obama Attorney General Eric Holder that allowed a number of low-level, nonviolent drug offenders to avoid what a lot of people see as overly punitive and ineffective mandatory minimum sentences, you know, a lot of which, of course, were put in place during the 1980s and early 1990s, that war on drugs. Now, when I read this, my immediate thought was, this is exactly what I expect from Jeff Sessions. I mean, he was a U.S. attorney during the 1980s and into the early 90s, which it seems to me that would be where many of his ideas about sentencing were developed. And that's understandable, but we're living in a very different world, and there's growing bipartisan consensus that the sentencing policies of that era, number one, were expensive, number two, they were ineffective, and that maybe they were an overreaction, particularly to that crack cocaine epidemic. But it seems to me that just like when it comes to marijuana legalization, Sessions has shown no interest in revisiting opinions he's formed well over a generation ago, despite what new evidence there is or how the situation or how the world may have changed in those intervening decades. So, Jay, what did you think about this?
Well, first, let's explain exactly what he did, because he didn't necessarily, it's not as if the attorney general can simply impose greater sentences or anything like that. What he did, and the way this works is there are a series of what are called sentencing guidelines that were put in place by Congress, again, back in the early 90s, predominantly to address things like, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic. And also concerns that there were people who were being let off with too lenient sentences. So Congress essentially cracked down on the judiciary and said, here's the deal for crimes, you know, X, Y, and Z. Here are the guidelines. If you take this into account, and here's this range. And if there's this, you know, contributing factor, then it adds this many years and so forth. It's a really long book, the sentencing guidelines. This is the way, and judges resisted this in a lot of ways because it took away their discretion to deal with, you know, crimes that perhaps shouldn't have been brought or where the punishment doesn't really fit what this person, what the defendant did. I clerked in, for the federal, circuit courts in 1999, 2000. And this was something we struggled with a great deal. Whereas the appeals court really had a lot of sympathy for some of these defendants who were being sentenced to terms that seemed inordinately long to what they had done. But, you know, if you looked at based on what the guidelines said, what the actual conduct was, what was proved and what the judge did, you sort of had no choice but to affirm. So, I mean, moving forward, what happened in the Eric Holder memo was that Holder instructed prosecutors to say, look, you don't have to charge a defendant with the highest possible crime and the highest penalty that would carry a mandatory minimum. And again, you know, prosecutors have a wide variety of options. Typically, when someone's arrested, it's not just hey, this guy committed this crime or is charged with this crime, there may be four or five or seven or 10 different things that this person could be charged with. And there's some discretion as to the charging. What Holder did was say, look, if you have the choice, you can charge them with something that doesn't carry a mandatory minimum. And what Sessions is saying is, It is now the official policy of the Justice Department to charge for the highest provable offense.
Right. And I believe part of that revolved around not instructing prosecutors to not necessarily specify the amount of drugs that were involved, because certain amounts sort of automatically require certain charges and so forth.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I think we should also point out, I've been nothing but harsh on Jeff Sessions, and I think deservedly so, but I should point out that the new policy does allow for exceptions based on what's called Attorney General called good judgment, subject to approval by either supervisors in the U.S. Attorney's offices or Justice Department headquarters. Now, a lot's going to depend on how that process plays out and what sort of exceptions are, in fact, allowed, I think. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the better way to express what Sessions has done with this change is it's probably less a change in policy and more just a change in tone. It's sort of the presumption before in the Holder era was sort of, we will charge them with the lowest crime we can support, absent other information. And the session sort of just flipped that presumption, saying we'll charge with the highest provable crime, absent other information. So, well, I understand it, because, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are being charged and put away for sentences that are inordinately long compared to what they've actually done. But I don't want to oversell this as sort of Jeff Sessions is just locking everyone up.
Well, you know, but I think you would agree, right, that a lot of people, even on the right, are saying, you know, this is a fiscal issue as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm saying it.
Yeah, okay. Right, I just wanted to be clear about that, because, I mean, this is one of the few issues that, in fact, when President Trump was first elected, one of the issues that some people thought, well, maybe Republicans and Democrats could work together on sentencing reform, you know, and I don't really see that happening. Certainly Jeff Sessions wouldn't be on board with that sort of thing. Now, I also wanted to point out that, you know, in 2016, which is the last year, we have good figures for, the total federal prisoner population was around 192,000, and that's down from 219,000 when Attorney General Holder released that mandatory minimum related memo. Now that's out of, to give people a sense of kind of the scope, that's out of a total prison population in the U.S. of around 1.53 million. In other words, federal prisoners make up around 12.5% of all prisoners. Most of them are not, you know, in federal custody, but state level and so forth.
You know, the other thing I wanted to mention about this, though, and it just to kind of raise the other side, in sort of Holder's defense, is the policy that the idea is that you would charge someone with the highest provable crime. Also goes to being able to get witnesses to flip on higher ups. And that is a tool that prosecutors use. And that's one that was cited for the policy change. And there's evidence to show that witness cooperation has decreased after the Holder memo, albeit slightly. The numbers I'm getting were from the Wall Street Journal that showed a drop of about 3% when they look at witnesses who were substantially cooperating and sort of rolling over on higher ups. So, I mean, I think there's an argument for you come in with the highest penalty possible and see if you can get someone to essentially rat out their, the higher ups. I'm not saying that's necessarily where I come down on the argument, but I think that's a non-frivolous argument to make. Yeah. Is sometimes it's helpful to have that bigger hammer.
No, that's a fair point. I think, you know, one final thing, at least for me, before we move on, is one of the problems with this, I think, with how stories like this are covered, is you tend to get a bunch of stories about kind of the initial announcement without necessarily the context about the exceptions and that sort of thing, kind of digging into what the former policy did. And what we're probably not going to see much of at all is any follow-up as to how this policy was actually implemented and what sort of changes it resulted in. Now, we're going to try to follow up on this and keep an eye on this, but it's almost certainly not the kind of thing that you're going to see much of in, you know, the Washington Post, Politico, that sort of thing, because it's just not the sort of, you know, thing that is exciting and new and sexy that those sort of outlets cover, unfortunately.
Right. Well, it would also be extremely research heavy.
Yeah.
In order to determine what the difference is under the new policy versus the old policy, you'd have to line up a whole bunch of people who were arrested and see what they did and then see what they were charged with and compare. And to have a meaningful sample would be a whole lot of work.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can see what this would be less hard. You can go and see what people were initially charged to and then what they pled to, for example, or what they were eventually convicted of. But still, it's one of those stories that if you're a reporter, I can see why you'd want to shy away from it, because it would be a whole lot of work and not a lot of splash.
No, exactly right. So, but we will try to keep an eye on it and give you some updates as events and data allow us to. So,
yeah.
All right. When you can't get things through Congress and you're the president, what do? Well, you sign executive orders.
Hand on a phone.
Exactly. You know, and President Trump has been very active on this front. One of his latest sets up a commission to study voter fraud and the integrity of the U.S. election system, with a charge to report back to the president on recommendations on eliminating vulnerabilities in the system. Now, the commission will be chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, but it's expected that the real work of the panel will be done by Vice Chair Chris Kobach, the Republican Secretary of State in Kansas, who's been a longtime advocate of some of the strictest voter ID laws in the country. Now, the plan is for the panel to consist of around a dozen or so members and include people from both parties. The conservatives generally approved of the move, while liberals, like me, see it as part of a long-standing Republican effort to suppress turnout of largely Democratic voters by making wildly inflated claims about vote fraud, which almost all rigorous analysis found to be nearly non-existent. Now, Jay, we've talked about this before, but what do you think, just in general, about this panel?
Oh, it's fine. Why wouldn't you? If there are vulnerabilities in the system, why not find out what they are and see if they can be made less vulnerable? I think this probably doesn't really do a whole lot, because again, consider that voting rights, voting laws are all made and enforced at the state level. I should back that up. There are certain federal Voting Rights Act type things that are obviously federally administered. But in terms of voter ID, in terms of who gets the vote when and how often and how late the polls stay open, that's typically a matter of a combination of state legislation and the state Secretary of State,
right?
Who regulates that. So, you know, I think you can have this commission who might come up with a bunch of recommendations, and they would say, we recommend this, this, and this. And various states will implement them. A lot of states won't. And that's going to turn probably on the politics of those individual states. I would also say probably the states that would make changes are the ones that probably already have, you know. And so I don't think there's going to be a whole lot new that comes out of this. And again, of course, the next step is then somebody sues and you got to go to court over it.
Yeah.
So I think it's Trump keeping a campaign promise to look into this. And look, I think integrity of elections is important. The Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, released a report a couple months back looking at situations where they have, again, this is documented, absolute, ironclad, prosecuted convictions, some of them convictions. I shouldn't say they're all convicted, but some of them were, where you have people who were not registered to vote, who were illegal immigrants, or other folks who were somehow disqualified for voting, who voted in the state of Ohio. Now, the number that he comes out on his report was there are about 83, I think, is the number that sticks out, which is a little short than the 3 million or something that Trump said voted illegally. But look, this is not it does happen. Even if you say it's 83 votes out of a state where I don't know, probably, you know, 8 million votes were cast. Probably not that many. I'd have to look up. But still, that's 83 people. And to some extent, if it's, it canceled out 83 other votes.
Let me throw some other numbers at you. There was a study done by a Loyola Law School professor who looked at voter impersonation, vote fraud, which is the type that most of these voter ID laws are aimed to kind of, you know, work on to minimize. Right. And what he looked at, all elections, federal elections between 2000 and 2014, that roughly over that period, slightly over 800 million ballots were cast. He found 35 total credible accusations of in-person vote fraud. Now, if you look at, so that's a tiny, 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 tiny percentage. Now, if you add in all types of vote fraud, I believe it was the Electoral Integrity Project, or I forget the name of it, but looked at 2000 through 2012. They found a total of 2,068 of all types of vote fraud through that period. This is a time where over 620 million votes were cast in national general elections. That's 0.00003%, I believe, of alleged cases of fraud for every vote cast. So it does happen. It is extraordinarily rare. I think you need to consider there's a cost benefit analysis here. And certainly in any election where there's any large number of people, there's going to be a tiny, tiny amount of fraud. But the concern on the left is that voter suppression issue, which is a much greater concern. Like, for instance, the Brennan Center. Now, I know probably how you feel about the Brennan Center, but they found that something like 25% of Black voting age citizens didn't have a government issued photo ID compared with 8% of white voting age citizens. And so, you know, and there are, in fact, have been Republicans who've been involved in this process who flat out said, well, this is, you know, a good thing for us to do to kind of help our voters and to kind of make it harder for the other party's likely voters. But that said, and we've had this discussion a lot of times, Jay, but I actually think that a panel or a commission might actually be a good thing if it's truly bipartisan and they make recommendations based on the evidence, taking into consideration not just the likely level of fraud, but also the effect that really strict voter ID laws have on suppressing the vote. I would welcome something
How do you measure that, though? I guess that's my thing is there's a measurement and a metric you can look at. If you have a voter ID law and you can say, okay, we caught X many people who violated this. I'm not sure how do you show these people were discouraged from voting or a population was somehow.
You do things like take a look at ease of access to getting required forms of identification, percentage of people who have those forms of identification, that sort of thing. I mean, it's not super straightforward, but you can get a sense of it, and it needs to be considered because it is a reasonable factor.
Okay.
So
I just end by the point I've made before. That though it's almost impossible to get a handle on it. And when we're talking about the voter ID fraud, the voter impersonation, a difficulty that you have is if you don't check IDs, you don't really screen for that. So you're always going to, it's sort of if you have two bars in town and one cards everyone at the door and the other doesn't, your chances of drinking underage at the one bar are a lot higher than the other.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that reasonable people can say, you know, and reasonable people should say we need to be concerned with the integrity of elections. Of course we should. Now, all evidence suggests it's not the concern that a lot of people make it out to be, nothing close to that. But if there is a way to, you know, institute a system that makes it even less of a concern, that doesn't have a disparate impact on, you know, minorities or Democratic voters, I'm all for that. You know, and I think everyone should be.
All right, we're on. We should sign up for the commission.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that'd be great. All right, let's move on to listener mail. We have a few questions or comments from listeners. First is Jennifer from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who writes, In your recent discussion on healthcare, Jay quoted from the Republican gospel of personal responsibility. I cannot get my head around the personal responsibility argument that simultaneously denies my ability to make the most intimate of decisions, what happens inside my own body. I would appreciate your explanation. All right, Jay, explain away.
Well, this is a tough one, and Jennifer, you might not like the answer I give. First of all, in terms of personal responsibility, the Republican position is you do have that autonomy. People have ready access to birth control. Saying that the government has to fund it, I think, is a separate issue. But it's not a case of where those decisions to engage in a activity that is likely to result in a child, there's a lot of personal responsibility there. And, people are going to, I know I'm going to get tons of mail on this, but call me old fashioned, but it's the truth. That said, I mean, obviously there are exceptions, cases of rape and incest and so forth like that. But if you're looking at the bigger picture of people having control over their own health, what they do, what they engage in, you have that. I think the Republican position on abortion is once you've got whether you call it a fetus or a child, I'll use both terms. At that point, the responsibility shifts to protecting that life that doesn't have the ability to protect itself. So I think that's striking a balance. And I get where people come from on the personal autonomy argument, because I'm in many ways a libertarian. But if you're asking how does personal responsibility fit into that, I guess that's my answer.
Okay. You know, one thing I wanted to point out, or at least my view on this is, you know, you talked about the Republican position. I think there are, you know, obviously a few Republican positions, and certainly there's one that, you know, in some states are trying to pass legislation or have legislation that don't necessarily make exceptions for rape or incest or the health of potential, you know, health threats to the mother. And from what you're saying, you think that those are reasonable exceptions to make. But of course, there are some conservatives who would say, you know, particularly some religious conservatives who would say, no, those aren't reasonable exceptions to make.
Yeah, no, there are always those people out there. And again, I, you know, we should be clear as we try to be. I'm not any sort of official spokesperson for the Republican Party or the conservative movement. I'm just a guy who went to school with Mike and has a microphone. So there's going to be differences all over the place, and you can see that in different states, and obviously in places that are more religiously inspired, you may get more stringent regulations. But I think, you know, the position that most of the Republican Party has adopted is they oppose abortion, but also recognize that here is a constitutional. Here's constitutional law as it stands now, most any sort of mainstream proposal I think you've seen has included protections for life and health of the mother.
Yeah,
and rape and incest exceptions.
Yeah. All right, moving on to our second question. The first one was kind of thrown to you. This one, I think, I'll try to tackle. It's from Delaney, who writes, "I've read many comments recently for both an independent commission and for a bipartisan congressional committee." This is about the Trump-Russia thing. "How do they differ in composition and investigative prosecutorial power? Keep up the great show. I always look forward to listening." Well, Delaney,
you got the easier question.
Yeah, I did, didn't I? That works out well for me this week. I looked into this a little bit. Here's the breakdown, basically. First, you have what's called the Select Committee. Now, this is members of Congress, and they don't necessarily have to reflect the chamber's partisan balance. Kind of like the Select Committee that investigated intelligence failures after 9/11. Select committees have subpoena power, but they can't bring criminal charges. Then you have independent commissions. Now, they're not necessarily members of Congress, though they can be. The 9/11 Commission's an example of this. They also,
or like the voter fraud commission.
Yeah, exactly. They also have subpoena power, but again, they can't bring charges. Of the two, a select committee tends to be quicker because the people and staff and so forth are already in place in Congress there. At least that's my view. Then you have a couple of other options. One's called a special prosecutor or a special counsel. Now, this is someone who's appointed by the attorney general. They can be fired by the president. They have subpoena power and they can bring charges. And so you do this in cases where you think that the attorney general feels that there's conflicts of interest, that this needs to happen outside, investigation has to happen outside of the Justice Department. And while the president can fire this person, that would be a real big storm of protest because these are supposed to be roughly kind of somewhat independent. Now, the most,
and I just add special prosecutor under the special prosecutor statute has really sort of all the resources of Justice Department and almost virtually unlimited resources, but really none of the accountability other than could be fired by the president, which, as you point out, there is a big political risk in doing that.
Yeah. And then finally, one option that's no longer on the table, just to be clear to everyone, is something called an independent counsel. And this was something that had been in place since not too long after Watergate, for obvious reasons, I think. And then it wasn't renewed in 1999, but it was legislation passed by Congress that an independent counsel could be named by the attorney general, would have all those kind of independent powers we talked about for the special prosecutor, but this person could not be fired by the president, and there's no end date to these investigations. And a lot of people started to feel that this was potentially an abuse of power. Justice Scalia, I believe, wrote a fairly blistering dissent when this came up before the Supreme Court. And so when it was up for renewal in 1999, Congress chose to not renew this statute. So those are basically the options in place there. So select independent commission or a special prosecutor, special counsel, though I would not hold my breath on any of that. I tend to think that what we're going to see is just what we have, the two investigations in the House and the Senate, and then the FBI investigation.
Yeah, and of course, House and Senate committees do have subpoena power, but like the others, can't necessarily bring criminal charges on their own, except for like a recommendation of contempt of Congress if somebody doesn't show up or lies. And, otherwise there has to be some sort of recommendation that goes to the Justice Department or some other prosecutor.
Right. You know, and just really briefly, since we're on this, I'm sure you've seen this, Jay, in the press this week. There have been a lot of liberals, at least, especially calling for bringing impeachment charges against President Trump for obstruction of justice. Now, that, of course, is not going to happen in a Republican-controlled House. But just briefly, we should talk maybe just briefly about obstruction of justice. Now, that's a really difficult thing to prove, or it would be in President Trump's case, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just basically because it kind of goes to the intent, and the argument on the left is, well, President Trump fired Comey because he was getting too close, and that was his intent, his mindset. And to prove that, you need to kind of get into the president's head and that's a really difficult thing to do, because even though he's made some statements, I don't think they're anything close to a sort of a legal standard of proof. Although, of course, the standard of proof in impeachment proceedings is whatever a majority of the House feels is the standard of proof. But there's no way that's going to happen.
That's the other sort of funny thing to keep in mind when it does come to the president. Really, the investigatory agency is the House. I mean, per the Constitution, that's really the only agency that has power to begin proceedings against the president. And the only proceedings you can really begin against the president are impeachment proceedings.
Yeah. And looking into the future, I know there are a lot of liberals who are sort of licking their chops at the prospect of maybe getting a majority in the House in 2018 and getting some real impeachment proceedings going for obstruction of justice and so forth. And just like I said on Facebook this week, I would remind my friends on the left who are eager to do that about how well it worked out for Republicans when they did the same thing to President Clinton, also on obstruction of justice charges in 1998. I think it would not be a tactic that would work out very well in the long term.
Yep. But I think Trump himself said it would be great TV.
Oh, God, it sure would. All right. It's time for What We're Reading, where we step back from the crazed pace of the news cycle and talk about the more in-depth, sort of thoughtful things that we're reading, listening to, or watching in the last week. So, Jay, why don't you start us off this week? What are you reading?
Okay. Well, I'm gonna take a little bit of an unusual tack here, in that I'm not going to name a sort of article or a piece that was, you know, in the press lately. I read a lot of old stuff. And what I've been reading lately is Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, Parts 1 and 2.
A classic.
And, pardon?
A classic.
A classic. And I just want to say, this is not for everyone. This is some serious heavy lifting. And I'll tell you, I'm reading it now, it's like I've been reading it sort of on and off for the last year or so. But it's fascinating in that, talking about perspective broader than the daily news. Spengler wrote this during World War I, when we're going through sort of an epochal change. And he writes about, when he says the decline of the West, it's not this idea of, oh boy, things are getting bad or things are going downhill, but he speaks in the broader terms of the decline of a culture, and that all cultures have sort of their birth and their flowering and they're declining. And it's not necessarily bad. It's just sort of the aging process. His prediction was that Western culture was going to more or less run out of gas around the year 2000. And he said this in, again, 1920 or so. But it's a fascinating look at what our culture actually is, because, again, that's something I think we don't think about that much. We think culture means, oh, it's our language, it's our heritage, it's ethnic food and cultural dancing. But he takes really the much deeper look at comparing, you know, Western culture, which is essentially sort of the culture of the Renaissance, to classical Greek Roman culture, to the what he calls the Magian culture of the Middle Ages, and different Asian cultures, in that there's something about it that just the way we think about time and space is fundamentally different. The way we think about numbers and measurement is fundamentally different, and how these ideas sort of go on to inform some of our other, you know, our art, our you know, even our political philosophy. So I'm just saying, if you want to take a step back and try to get some sort of big picture. And again, it's also a little weird in that Spengler writes in a time before we really had the social science, all the data that we do now.
Right.
But he's still sort of surprisingly accurate. So anyway, if you're really up for it, if you're up for a challenge, and again, I'm not saying This ain't easy. And also, I would say get a good translation, because it's one of those things of Spengler obviously wrote in German. And the translation of, you know, 30 German words that are like 30 letters long into English, some translations are better than others.
Sure.
That's my big highbrow. Yeah, what I'm reading for this week.
All right, and we will post a link with the best translation that we're aware of, so you can check that out. My reading this week is also a book, not nearly as highbrow, but still, you know, not fluff. It's The End of Alchemy by Mervyn King. He's the guy who ran the Bank of England from 2003 to 2013. So he was, of course, one of the key players in the reaction to that worldwide financial crisis of 2008 and its aftermath. And in his book, he talks not just about the crisis, but also he gets into the history of money, which is really pretty fascinating. And because once you start thinking about what money is, it really kind of makes your head kind of spin a little bit, at least mine. And he also has some recommendations for reforms of the worldwide financial system. And, you know, I've read a lot on the financial crisis, both because just personally I found it fascinating, but also because I was teaching students about it in various classes in economic policy and so forth. But most of my reading has been from the U.S. perspective, and so now I'm sort of trying to get a more global sense of things. I initially started out by picking up a book by Neil Irwin called The Alchemists, and it got really good reviews, but it was too much kind of behind the scenes personality based stuff, which sort of makes sense. Irwin's a journalist and a very good one, but there wasn't enough kind of policy wonkery to suit me. And so I found The End of Alchemy, which I think not too long ago just came out in paperback. And so far I found it to be a really fascinating book. King's a really interesting guy, and I would definitely recommend it to everyone.
Okay.
All right. Well, that about does it for this week's show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you want to share, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. And our Facebook page, where you can message us and where we post throughout the week, that's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. You know, we really appreciate our great listeners who have generously supported this show through their donations. And if you'd like to join them, you can do that through the Patreon or PayPal links on our website, politicsguys.com. And if money's tight or you're already a supporter, we hope you'll consider hitting the share icon on your podcast app to pass along this episode to your friends, your followers, your crew, whatever. Leaving ratings and reviews of the show on your app and sharing and retweeting our new show posts and tweets, that also really helps to spread the word. That brings in new listeners, that leads to more donations and advertisers, all that stuff that makes it possible for us to do this show on a regular basis. We'll be back with a new interview this Wednesday and our weekly analysis of the news on Sunday. We hope you'll join us.